the beluga, the walrus, the bullhead whale, and all the different species of animals. They cannot be here, but I am here for them.
Environmental groups rally against Shell's Arctic drilling plans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage comes close to setting a record for the number of bear attacks in one season.
I don't know why all of these have happened but this year, but the types of encounters that have happened could happen anytime.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, providing diagnostic mammogram results to patients within one working day, led by Drs. Denise Farley and Heather Tauschik, provimaging.com.
Environmentalists are urging the EPA to block Shell's request for a waiver from the Clean Air Act for its Discoverer vessel. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, groups have collected hundreds of thousands of signatures opposing the compliance order.
It was a typical summer day in Washington, with the humidity on full blast and the temperature rushing toward the 90s before noon. And much like any other summer day in Washington, this one was complete with a protest, albeit a small, muted one. A few more than a dozen activists gathered at the national headquarters of the Environmental Protection Agency to present EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson with 360,000 letters. Letters that urge her to make sure Shell plays by the rules, as environmental groups are phrasing it. Cindy Shogan directs the Alaska Wilderness League.
I think EPA needs to do a full comment period on allowing them not to meet their permits.
A public comment period could take months to complete, nearly certainly throwing Shell off its schedule. Shell requested the compliance order for the vessel a few weeks ago. The company concedes it cannot meet emissions requirements for its main generator under the Clean Air Act. In a statement, the EPA says it's working with Shell to grant the approval, and it's confident the company will be able to begin as planned this year. That's maddening to Travis Nichols. He's with Greenpeace and says if EPA grants the waiver, it could set precedent for offshore drilling everywhere.
It says that big oil can change the rules and that big oil can move the goalposts before the game begins and there are no consequences.
Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar says he'll make a final decision on whether Shell can proceed by August 15th. He told the New York Times last week nothing is guaranteed at this point. The department could ultimately not grant its final permit. Though some people could be reading the tea leaves from the news of the day. The environmental groups delivered their letters of opposition on the same day the Obama administration announced its plan to hold a lease sale off of Texas for 20 million acres of unleased waters in the western Gulf of Mexico. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Protesters also gathered at the EPA office in downtown Anchorage. Fewer than a dozen people showed up in light rain. They held up anti-drilling signs and hoped for encouragement from passing motorists. Earl Kingick is from Point Hope, Alaska. He said he attended the rally on behalf of the animals who couldn't be there.
The beluga, the walrus, the bullhead whale, and all the different species of animals, they cannot be here, but I am here for them. And I am here for my people. My people need the garden that we love the most. That's what keeps our people together for thousands and thousands of years. Point Hope is the oldest inhabited community, and we want to keep it that way for another 1,000 years.
Lindsay Hyduk is with the Sierra Club in Anchorage. She wasn't particularly concerned about the low turnout.
Even though it's a smaller crowd, it is passionate and it represents a passionate crowd within Alaska itself.
Lindsay Hyduk with the Sierra Club in Anchorage. The Coast Guard is relaxing certification standards for Shell's oil spill containment barge. The company convinced regulators the Arctic Challenger should be considered a mobile unit. Among other things, that means its mooring system only needs to be able to weather a 10-year storm as opposed to the more rigorous 100-year standard for fixed platforms. Coast Guard Commander Chris O'Neill says the change was based on a more complete understanding of how the ship would be used. The Challenger is carrying equipment that could help cap an out-of-control well. During the drilling season, the Challenger will anchor in between the Beaufort and Chukchi Sea, but could move to either if there's a spill, O'Neill says. For that reason, a mobile classification made more sense.
The 10-year criteria is an industry-recognized standard that applies to mobile offshore drilling units, which are capable of moving in advance of major storms.
But the change in certification standards doesn't mean the barge has been approved to head north. O'Neill couldn't provide a timeline for how long that could take, saying it's up to Shell and their contractors. Shell spokesman Curtis Smith couldn't specify a timeline either, but said the company is hoping to have the Challenger in the Arctic in the near future. Shell can't start drilling until the barge is approved. O'Neill says the Coast Guard won't rush the process, though, even if it means Shell isn't able to drill this summer. The Los Angeles Times reports that the barge was scheduled to be inspected today, but that has been pushed back indefinitely. A man was mauled by a brown bear yesterday in Eagle River. He sustained serious but non-life-threatening injuries. It was the fourth bear attack in Anchorage this year, one of the highest numbers ever, and the city is on its way to reaching a new record. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reports.
Bob Eater was walking his beagle along a narrow dirt path to a privately owned cabin in Eagle River. Fireweed and cow parsnips were thick and 6 feet high on either side of the trail. When Eater first saw the four brown bears, they were already just 5 feet away. Jesse Coltrane, wildlife biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says Eater probably surprised a sow with her three large cubs.
I don't believe that bear spray or a firearm would have helped him, because I honestly think it probably happened so fast that he wouldn't have been able to get to either thing. So at 5 feet, if she came right at him, that's going to happen instantaneously.
Eater ended up with a deep laceration on his leg. He is the fourth bear mauling victim this year in Anchorage, which is a higher number of incidences than usual, according to Coltrane. The last time there were four bear attacks in a summer was in 2008, and this summer isn't over yet. There are usually one, maybe two bear attacks a year, and often a year goes by without any maulings in Anchorage. But Coltrane says the circumstances of all the attacks this year were pretty typical. In three of the instances, a sow was protecting her cubs, and in one case, a hiker happened upon a bear's freshly killed moose. Three occurred when a hiker surprised a bear in dense vegetation.
I don't know why all of these have happened the types of encounters that have happened could happen anytime.
Coltrane says it isn't necessarily that there are more bears in human territory. She said it could just mean that there are more people in the bear's territory.
We have more people recreating out there in bear country than we've ever had in the past. You know, if you go to Chugach State Park, every parking lot is packed. Bicentennial Park, every parking lot is packed all the time. There are a lot more people out there.
Coltrane hopes the summer bear attacks don't incite more fear for outdoor adventures, but instead inspires more wildlife education and preparedness.
I'm not telling people not to get out there. You know, just go forth and be aware of your surroundings and educate yourself.
Many popular hiking trails in the Anchorage area weave through bear habitat. Coltrane recommends hiking in groups and being loud to avoid surprising a bear. And she recommends carrying bear spray just in case. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonathan.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, turning to Facebook to catch a thief.
It may be vigilante justice, I don't know. It's just, I don't feel it's fair to the community for this guy to be able to do this and nothing to come of it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
A new genetic study of polar bears out from the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences today shows the species is older than previously thought. The study also suggests that intermingling with brown bears could have been in partial response to previous changes in the Earth's climate. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Previous studies suggest the polar bear as a species is roughly 600,000 years old. But a more thorough look at the marine mammal's DNA indicates the species is between 4 and 5 million years old. Dr. Sandra Talbot is a geneticist with the USGS at the Alaska Science Center in Anchorage. She's one of 26 authors of a study that takes a more comprehensive look at polar bear genetics.
There is so much information in this, and there's so much more that needs to be looked at. For me, the biggest surprise was the timing of the divergence.
Previous studies used mitochondrial DNA to explore polar bear genetics, which provides only small snippets of the bear's evolutionary history. The new study uses more comprehensive nuclear DNA from 28 bears, including a 120,000-year-old fossil, to look at similarities between polar bears and their brown and black counterparts.
My mitochondrial DNA will only pass from my daughter down through evolutionary time to her daughter and her daughter's daughter and her daughter's daughter's daughter. So it's called a maternal lineage. The nuclear genome, of course, is inherited biparentally. You get part of your nuclear genome from your mother. You get part of your nuclear genome from your father. And so it tells you a different story.
The study also shows that polar bears and brown bears have interbred or hybridized for much longer than scientists theorized. Talbot says that intermingling between species coincides with previous climate warming periods in Earth's history.
This gives us one hint that, oh yeah, here's a high-latitude species that was involved in a hybridization event, and those events may have occurred, you know, as a result of changes in the environment. We don't know for sure. That's an additional story that needs to be brought out. But since we have whole genomic information, we can start to look at that.
Talbot says the study provides information about polar bears' resiliency to past climate changes. The polar bear population is much lower today than it was 5 million years ago. Talbot says it's unclear how the study might influence resource management decisions in the future. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Community Development Quota, or CDQ, program for 20 villages along the Bering Sea recently handed out 100 free nets in Bethel. For most of the summer, subsistence fishermen on the Kuskokwim River have been restricted to smaller nets to protect Chinook salmon. Coastal Villages Region Fund says the nets were gone within an hour. But as KYUK's Sophie Ivan reports, the nets didn't change hands without some controversy.
To get the nets, fishermen had to sign a page-long acceptance agreement, basically stating that the pollock fishery provided the money for the nets. CVRF has long said their pollock fishery subsidizes the region's salmon and halibut commercial fisheries in the millions.
A lot of people in the region don't know, or they don't see that Coastal Villages earns money in the Bering Sea from the pollock fishery.
Dawson Hoover is a spokesman for CVRF. He says the statement was required as a way to help educate the fishermen.
All that money pays for the salmon fishing operations, the halibut fishing operations. It pays for the jobs we provide in Platinum, and it pays for our community service centers. It pays for a lot of things in the region that are subsidized.
However, some believe the pollock fleets intercept too many Chinook salmon headed for the Yukon and Kuskokwim. Both rivers are suffering with the worst king wrens on record. One of the groups pointing fingers at the pollock fleets is the Association of Village Council Presidents, which represents 56 tribes in the Waikei Delta. The association prompted CVRF to help supply fishermen with the free legal-sized nets. Myra Nanning is AVCP's president.
We're thankful that they made the nets available. However, we have concerns about the document that they put together to have people sign because we didn't think that was necessary, and we were kind of surprised that CVRF put that document together the way they did.
However, CVRF says they didn't catch too many salmon. According to the statement fishermen had to sign, of the 106 million pounds of pollock they harvested last year, they took only 320 Chinook as bycatch. In the statement, CVRF also says the allocations to the CDQ groups are unfair and that they get less allocation per resident than other CDQs. The statement asks the fishermen to contact their congressional delegation to seek changes. To further the controversy, the free nets were given out in Bethel.
Even though Bethel is not a member CVRF member village, he went ahead and distributed nets to them, and that doesn't seem right.
Patrick Pavila is a tribal administrator of Tundudulak, one of CVRF's member villages. He says when he first heard about the free nets, He assumed they would go to CVRF villages, not to the region's hub community.
And to be left out on this occasion, with especially with nets, where in a village, job security is not something that is guaranteed, and we mostly live by subsisting.
Pevela says he has called and emailed CVRF but hasn't heard back from them. Not everyone got mixed up in the politics, though. Fisherman Joan Neck of Bethel felt lucky to snag a free net and didn't have a problem with signing the statement.
I was like a young person again signing that paper, and I'm really happy.
CVRF says they are in the process of distributing 140 more nets. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Van.
Studies related to the proposed Susitna-Watonna hydroelectric dam were put forward last week by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. KTNA's Lorian Nettleton has more.
The second scoping document issued by FERC attempts to identify as many pertinent issues as possible associated with the construction of a 700 to 800-foot dam on the Susitna River near Watonna Creek. The second document is substantially larger than the first, taking into account more than 500 comments from state and federal agencies, NGOs, Native corporations, and the general public. At the same time, the Alaska Energy Authority submitted their proposed study plan, which describes the methods by which 58 studies will try to answer the numerous questions over the next 2 years prior to the license application for the dam, currently scheduled for September 2015. Project manager for the dam, Wayne Dyack, says the AEA has modified many of the plan studies to address the comments they received.
That's really where the effort has been, to make sure that our study plans go through each of those comments and include things that are raised.
Such additions to the studies include resource valuation for fish, expanded seismic studies, and flood mapping in the event of dam failure triggered by earthquakes, as well as modeling of wintertime ice formation below the dam. And while requests to include climate change studies were not included by FERC, Dyack says the AEA is going ahead with a study on the impacts of a warming climate on the glaciers that feed the Susitna River.
We want to have robust study plans and do a good job of answering the questions so people feel like we're providing this information in an open, honest, and transparent manner.
A majority of the comments reflected concerns about the project's effects on the fish, wildlife, and river ecosystem, recreation and tourism, fishing and hunting, public safety, the uses of Native corporation lands, and demands on public services. Talkeetna Community Council member Whitney Wolf says the many additions to the second scoping document confirm the concerns about the project were deemed relevant.
They did put the majority of missing elements from the scoping document 1 into this latest scoping document 2, so that's encouraging. I would say, 80% of it, possibly, of the comments that were submitted were worthy to be included as resource issues to be looked at, so that's good.
Among the comments dismissed by FERC was a request to conduct a nationwide valuation study to determine whether hydroelectricity for Alaska's rail belt trumps a national need for wild, scenic, and pristine wilderness.
It was backed by a couple tribal councils, and it was also requested by National Marine Fisheries, which is one of the mandatory conditioning agencies involved in the project. So it was definitely proposed by a lot of entities, and they denied that.
Comment and review of the second scoping document and the proposed study plans will continue until October. In Talkeetna, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Wrangell's milling industry is taking a new turn towards niche markets. Ron Franz of Whale Bay Woods is cutting and selling music wood for instrument makers around the world. He spoke with KSTK's Ann Hillman about what makes Wrangell's Sitka spruce sing so sweetly.
You can't tell if a tree will make a fine-tuned guitar just by looking at it, but Ron Franz says you sometimes have other quick options.
And one of the ways is just to smack the log. I mean, if it has a nice hollow vibration to it, You know, I think it's going to be a good sound wood.
Sitka spruce is one of the best woods in the world for making acoustic guitars. It has all of the ideal properties.
Sitka has a high resonance, has good fluctuation and modulus, but it also is very tough, so it lasts longer on a commercial instrument.
What he means is it sounds good. It vibrates perfectly when you strum the guitar strings.
If you have the wrong woods, you'll only have maybe a real good high range, but not good low range, or the opposite.
To get good music wood, you first have to select the right trees. Franz and his company, Whale Bay Woods, started sourcing wood from Prince of Wales Island in the 1990s. Last year, Franz set up shop in Wrangell. He says it's the best music wood he's seen in the region for a number of reasons.
I think it's more protected in here. There are a lot more storms and weather on the outside. And here, I think the trees just grow straighter.
The wood has to look good, too, since it's used for the face of the guitar. Franz says the best trees for music wood are old and at the very end of their life cycles. That works well with the current harvest strategy on Wrangell Island.
Well, with the new pilot microcell program that the Forest Service is doing, you go out and select the trees. It's either dead or already blown down or dying. And so these trees aren't going to last much longer anyway, so that's their way of making the wood useful. And we pick those out, turn them into the Forest Service, they scale them up, and we buy them.
One of the highest quality trees he bought was already dead and the resin had drained out. After the trees are selected comes the cutting process. It requires precision because that can also have an impact on the tone of the instrument.
Then we take the board, we split them out so that they follow the grain perfectly, which is big. I mean, the more perfectly you follow the grain, the longer your tone will sustain in there. Where if the grains are off a little bit, then it just kind of like, you know, leaks away. So we hand split them and then saw them into 3/16 book match tops, quarter sawn. And if you quarter saw it, then that adds a high degree of stiffness.
Then, sometimes, you can tell right away if the wood will sing.
You can hold a board in your hand and be talking like this and feel it vibrate in your hand. I mean, if it's really high, a high resonance. And so if you're sitting there singing, it just sitting there going like this, vibrating in your hand. And it's amazing.
But what Franz says isn't dead is the milling industry in Wrangell. By specializing in music wood, he makes about $30 to $40 per board foot. And the parts of the wood that can't go toward instruments can still be sold as airplane wood and even arrow shafts for the blossoming archery market. In Wrangell, I'm Ann Hillman.
You may use Facebook to share photos from your summer vacation or goof off at work. But Sitka resident Rick Armstrong has found a different use for the social network. He's using Facebook to try to catch a thief. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
In early June, someone broke into the Baranoff Island Brewing Company, which Rick Armstrong owns with his wife, and stole over $1,000 from the cash register and a case of beer. The thief was captured on video by a security camera, but the tape wasn't high enough quality to identify him. Now, however, Armstrong thinks he has his man.
There is no doubt. I'm 100% sure that this is our guy.
In fact, says Armstrong, he's known who the thief is for weeks, and so have the Sitka police. But thus far, there's been no arrest. And so, frustrated with the pace of the investigation, Armstrong took matters into his own hands. Yesterday morning, he posted a photo to the Baranoff Island Brewing Company's Facebook page. It shows a young man with long sideburns and a black bar across his eyes to conceal, at least slightly, his identity. Armstrong says it's the burglar, whom he's calling the brewery bandit. But the photo isn't from the surveillance tape. Armstrong took it from the man's Facebook page. The caption reads, "Yes, bandit, we know who you are. Please return what you have stolen from us to the Sitka Police Department ASAP. More pictures, names, and information to follow. Cheers."
It may be vigilante justice. I don't know. It's just, I don't feel it's fair to the community, to my family, our employees, for this guy to be able to do this. And everyone knows he's done it, and nothing to come of it.
Armstrong didn't name the man on Facebook, but he says if the man doesn't come forward and the police don't make an arrest, he'll keep releasing information.
Next will be clear shots of his face and his name and the other folks that were involved.
This has posed a challenge for the Sitka Police Department.
Well, I appreciate Mr. Armstrong's frustration. We have to operate by certain rules, and the public doesn't always understand those rules.
That's Sitka Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt.
What may seem slow to him is just a product of the system that we have to work within in order to investigate burglaries and do it in such a way that they can be prosecuted.
Schmidt says he sympathizes with Armstrong.
They were victimized. People broke into their business and took money from them. So I definitely empathize with them.
But, he says, the police are pursuing their own investigation, and the public airing of evidence and accusation can complicate that process.
In general terms, posting things on Facebook to try to investigate a crime could be dangerous for the individual, that you could make a target out of yourself. And furthermore, yeah, you can certainly hamstring the police as they try to investigate. And it could put us outside of the rules that we have to operate by.
In the meantime, the hunt for the brewery bandit has become a social event, both online and off.
We get phone calls, it seems like almost daily, of people that have seen him and know what's going on, and they're like, why hasn't something been done?
When the burglary first happened, Armstrong posted the surveillance video to Facebook and YouTube to see if he could crowdsource the thief's identity.
We see him come in the building, we see him walk through the building, we see him in the till, in the register. We watch him walk over to the cooler, the bottle cooler, load his backpack with bottles, and then put on his backpack as he goes out the door. We see all of that.
The Facebook post led to other evidence, which Armstrong said he isn't yet ready to make public.
I really don't think I can share that just yet. It's going to come out slowly one way or the other. Hopefully the Sitka police arrest him.
Either way, he says, he feels the evidence is ironclad. Is there any chance you might be wrong, that you might have the wrong person and might sort of plaster the wrong person's face all over Facebook with this accusation?
At the beginning, I definitely was very concerned about that, and that's why we made sure of the information that we have, that it's 100% sure that this is our guy.
And that may be good enough for Facebook. But Schmidt says the legal system has a different standard.
I think people understand, I hope that they understand, that we have to do things according to certain rules so that we don't violate people's rights. People have rights, and we take those very seriously.
Even if they are the brewery bandit. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Sophie Ivan in Bethel, Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna, Ann Hillman in Wrangell, and Rachel Waldholz in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Wendy Jonathan from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.